Luke put down his glass. Something wrong with Monica? Nothing is wrong with Monica, I replied, which was 100% true. But she can't make it. The dishwasher quit, they're short on waitstaff, and they've got a big party coming in, a wedding rehearsal dinner. She can't get away. Okay, yes. I embellished Monica's list of excuses and left out the part about the imaginary brain tumor. There was no reason Luke needed to know about Monica's hypochondria until he had a chance to notice all the good things about her, which I was currently struggling to remember. Things that make up for the fact that she is, let's face it, a little nuts. But I was convinced that falling in love, or even in like, with a guy like Luke, would be the antidote to her imaginary diseases. The only thing she really suffered from was loneliness. There's a lot of that going around. Oh, he said. His expression was sort of unreadable. Huh. That's too bad. I stuffed my phone into my bag and took a slurp from my glass, feeling ridiculous. I'm really sorry. I'll just finish my drink and then get out of your hair. He frowned. Why? I thought we were having dinner. The server said the gift cards had already been entered and that we could order any time. Luke, I said, tilting my head to one side, you don't have to pretend. We both know what's going on here. I'm only here because Monica was nervous about dating again and wanted me alone for moral support. I picked up my glass and drained it by half, anxious to save us both further embarrassment by making a quick getaway from an awkward situation. Don't let this discourage you, okay? Monica's life is complicated, I admitted. Vince was serially unfaithful to her. Now she's left holding the bag, doing her best to take care of two teenage stepkids and run the restaurant. Monica trained as a chef, not a businesswoman, or a mother. She tries, but she's in way over her head. I tipped the wine glass high against my lips and gulped the contents. Don't give up on her. She's a good person. I pushed back my chair. Next time, you ask her out. You won't regret it.
Grace?
Yes?
Sit down.
Something about his tone reminded me of my high school history teacher, Mr. Harding, who ran such a tight ship that we didn't breathe without raising a hand to ask permission first. I sat down. The server passed by and saw my empty glass.
Wow, that was quick. You must have been thirsty. Can I bring you another?
No, I'm fine. I was just...
Yes, please. Another round for both of us.
Luke's voice seemed to affect the server the same way it did me. She hurried off to do his bidding.
So, he said, let me clear up a couple of things. I'm not interested in dating Monica. I'm here because I'm trying to get my business going, and because there was no way I was going to turn down free oysters. I developed a taste for them while I was in France, and for good wine.
He lifted his glass to his lips and took another sip.
I'll tell you something, he said, his voice wistful. French food. He spread his hands. There's just no word for how good it is.
Really?
I said, propping my chin in my hand. Really? Have you ever had poached quail eggs with hollandaise? Or potatoes fried in duck fat? You should. Not too much because it's so rich. But that's the thing about French cooking. Small portions, but incredibly satisfying. He took a drink. Sorry, I didn't mean to change the subject. I'm boring you.
Not at all. I'm fascinated. I've always dreamed of going to France.
You should. I'm really glad to be back in the States, especially Oregon. But France is a wonderful place to visit. And dining out in the Loire Valley, even at the simplest little bistro, was a real experience. But... he said, taking another sip. I hate eating out by myself.
Oh, I hear you. Makes me feel so conspicuous. I always think people are staring at me. At home, you can at least turn on the TV for company.
Luke nodded his understanding. Since I came back to Portland, Alex Trebek and I have become very close.
You like Jeopardy? I pegged you as more of an ESPN guy.
I'd rather play sports than watch them. But if we're sizing each other up...
He narrowed his eyes, made a show of examining my face.
PBS, he said, snapping his fingers.
You like Masterpiece Theater and Nova, am I right?
Turner classics. I love old movies. I like knowing good guys from bad guys and being certain that, in the end, the good guy wins.
Happy endings, Luke said. Real life ought to come with more of those.
He took another drink. I did the same, then put down my glass and ran my finger around the rim, trying to decide if I should ask the obvious question.
So, you ran away to France for 3 years. Now you're back, and you and Alex Trebek are besties.
Divorce?
He nodded. Yeah, but that happened a couple of years before I went to France. I came home from the office one day, announced that I was leaving the law firm. Within a month, I opened my carpentry business. Within a year, I knew I would fail if I didn't find a way to offer something other people couldn't. I needed more training. So I did some research and found a master carpenter in Amboise who was willing to take on an American apprentice, then sold my stuff and booked my ticket. But the marriage was really over on the day I quit the firm. She moved out the next week.
I get it, he shrugged.
She didn't sign up to be married to a tradesman, and I didn't sign up to work in a job I hated to support a lifestyle I didn't give a damn about. We just wanted different things. No hard feelings. You?
I put my hands in my lap, felt the indentation at the base of my finger where my ring should have been.
It's... complicated?
I nodded, but not just because I didn't want to talk about it. It really was complicated. And sad. And I wasn't up for sad just then. Luke was right. Real life ought to come with more happy endings. Who do I see to complain about that?
I should go. Luke swallowed quickly.
Don't. Stay and have dinner with me.
I can't. This is just too...
The word dangerous unexpectedly popped into my mind. I mentally swept it under the rug.
Awkward. But thank you for the drink.
I stood up. Luke did the same, but more quickly. He reached out as if he meant to grab my arm, but I shifted to the side, avoiding his touch.
Was it because I asked about your ex?
Hey, none of my business. We don't have to talk about it. We can talk about old movies, or our favorite books, or golf.
Golf?
Golf, goldfish, anything you want. We can sit here and exchange recipes for all I care. Just please, Grace, sit back down. You can't go.
He sounded a little desperate. I frowned.
Why not?
Because of that. He pointed across the restaurant. Two servers were walking toward our table with enormous platters of seafood.
You were late, so I went ahead and ordered about $80 worth of appetizers, he explained. I can't eat all that by myself, but if you leave, I'll have to. I'm a product of my hard scrabble, clear your plate because children are starving in the third world upbringing, so I'll have no choice.
Come on, Grace. Help me out here.
His voice was pleading and charming. So charming that I had to smile a little. Luke walked around to my side of the table and pulled my chair out again.
You said you like oysters, right?
Chapter 5. Nan. If Nelson were human, I'd have given him a cup of tea and a peach turnover, my standard protocol for people who've suffered a loss. But dogs are different. Suffering comes as more of a shock to dogs, because they can't see it coming. Even when unexpected, people have a basic understanding that tragedy comes to everyone eventually, and so are more readily comforted by small acts of kindness. Like people, dogs experience grief in different ways. Some move through it quickly, attaching themselves to someone new so easily that it seems they barely miss the someone who came before. I'm not saying that a dog who attaches quickly to a new human didn't feel love for the one who passed. Far from it. But over the years, I've noticed that those who had suffered more before their adoption and were rescued from some traumatic situation tend to grieve longer and more deeply than most. What I knew of Nelson's history, related to me by a neighbor familiar with his situation, bore this out. Nelson was just a puppy when Helen Find, his departed owner, discovered him shivering and abandoned by some garbage cans near her garage. He was worm-ridden, flea-infested, and so skinny that Helen assumed he was feral. But when she reached out her hand, the pup got down low and scooted toward her on his belly, frightened, but so eager for love and affection that he took the risk. From that moment on, Helen and the dog were inseparable, absolutely devoted to each other. When the cancer got so bad, the neighbor said, Helen refused to go to the hospital unless Nelson could come along. Of course, they couldn't do that, so the doctors called hospice. It was too late by then, anyway. Do you know that dog never left her side? Not for 1 minute? And when she finally passed, he whined and cried like his heart was broken. It was almost human. Never saw anything like it, he said. Helen Fine's neighbor sounded surprised. I wasn't. I'd seen it before, and not just in dogs. Nelson and Helen's story was one of true love. Most people don't understand it because they've never experienced it. Those who have never forget. They can learn love and trust again, but it takes patience, understanding, and time. How much time? There's no way of telling. You just have to wait. The only thing I could do for Nelson at that moment was hold him. And so I did, stroking his black and silver head until he fell asleep. Then I carried him across the room to Blixen, who had been watching patiently from her bed. "Here you go, Blix," I whispered. Blix rolled onto her side, and I tucked Nelson up close. Blixen curled herself into a C around Nelson's body, sighed, and closed her eyes. Poor Nelson. I've fostered over 100 dogs in my lifetime. It's never easy to see them grieve. But it's something I'm called to by temperament, experience, and circumstances. My Jim was killed in a plane crash when I was only 42, so I'm acquainted with grief. But Jim and I had a good life. Apart from our time together being too short, I have no regrets. Jim left me with 4 wonderful reasons to go on living, too. Jim Jr., whom we called James, was 12 when his dad died. Chrissy, Matt, and Danny were 10, 8, and 5. Later, I adopted 3 more children, Kyle, Brianna, and Emily, all teenagers when they came. Older kids can be hard to place, but they deserve stable homes, too. I tried to provide that for all my kids, biological and adopted, as well as an education. James is a radiologist, and Chrissy went into teaching. Matt and Kyle went into business together, designing video games. Brianna is a social worker. Emily married Dan, who opened his own microbrewery near Bend. She's a stay-at-home mom to 2-year-old twin boys. It gets lonely sometimes now that the kids are grown. But I keep busy. In helping other people, I help myself as well. I believe that everything, the good and the bad, happens for a reason and is part of something bigger. Purpose, with a capital P. I also believe we each have an individual purpose, lowercase p, that fits in with the grander plan. And that part of the reason we're here is to find it. Because everyone matters. Each person's contribution, large or small, has an impact. Losing Jim was just that, a loss, a terrible one. But in enduring that loss, I came to find my purpose, to comfort and nurture others. First our grieving children, then other people's children. Now any person or pet who crosses my path and needs what I might have to offer. Tea and a turnover, a word of encouragement, a listening ear, a way station on the path to a new home. Nurturing and comforting. That's why I'm here in this place, in this moment. That's my purpose. And I'm fortunate to have the resources to fulfill it. I'm not wealthy. In fact, I live quite frugally. Insurance and the settlement from the airplane manufacturer allowed me to stay home with the children and keep my house and land. 1.5-acre lots are impossible to come by in Portland now. Not a week passes without some developer knocking on my door. I'll never sell. I was born in this house. My memories are here, and so is my garden. Where else would I have room to grow my tomatoes and artichokes and rhubarb, 6 varieties of basil, my clary sage and elephant garlic? And I could never leave my blueberry bushes. My father planted those bushes. Even if I could find a house with sufficient land, it wouldn't have soil like mine. How many cubic yards of compost have I worked into it over the years? My garden soil is black gold, priceless. And where would I keep the chickens if I moved? My coop has room for 25 birds. When the kids lived at home, I needed that many hens to keep us in eggs. I only keep a half dozen now, but it's nice that they have room to roam. Besides the chickens, there are the dogs to consider. Normally, I don't have more than 2 foster dogs at a time, so they can stay inside the house. Every now and then, the rescue faces a sudden emergency, and I'll have to take in several dogs on short notice. That's why I converted the old goat barn into a comfy, state-of-the-art kennel with heated floors, good ventilation, a hot water bathing station, and pens for up to 8 dogs. James drove up from Ashland with Layla and the kids and spent a whole week helping me with the remodeling. That's another reason I'll never leave this house. The kids. The whole crowd and all 8 grandchildren show up every summer, second week in July, for our annual homecoming week. When the garden is at its peak and the grandkids are outside hooting and whooping in a wild game of tag while the grown-ups sit on the deck sharing memories and a bottle of wine, there's no place in the world I'd rather be. That's as good as life gets. No, I'll never sell my house, not for any price. There are certain things money can't buy. On the other hand, there are times when it comes in awfully handy, which is what prompted me to phone Monica. I knew she was out with Grace, so I only planned to leave a message. I didn't expect her to pick up. "Why are you answering your phone?" "Because it rang." "But you shouldn't be taking calls while you're on your date." "My date?" Monica sounded confused. "Oh, I ended up not going. The restaurant is slammed and my head is killing me. I'm going to urgent care later." "Oh, Grace was getting all dressed up when I talked to her. She must have been disappointed." "No, no, she's fine. I sent a text, told her and Luke to have fun without me." "Wait," I said slowly, certain I must have heard her wrong. "You mean Grace was already at the restaurant when you sent a text to say you weren't coming? She'd be having dinner with a total stranger." "So? What's the difference? It isn't like I know him either." "She knows you. That would have made it less awkward." "Don't you think..." I let my question trail off, realizing that there was no point. Monica has a good heart, the best. Look at how she'd taken in Desmond. He's such a sweet dog, but Newfoundlands are so enormous. She'd give you the shirt off her back if you asked for it, but she's not the most emotionally sensitive person I've ever met. "She'll be fine," Monica said breezily. "Luke's a nice guy, and she needs to get out more. So what's up?" Between Monica's cut-to-the-chase tone and the background music of banging pots and pans, I knew the restaurant was busy and she had work to do. "Nothing important. We can talk later," I said. "It's okay, I've got a minute. What do you..." "Hang on a sec." Monica moved the phone away from her mouth, but she was shouting, so I had no trouble hearing. "Hey, there's a piccata order for table 6 sitting here. Think one of you could quit examining your navel long enough to take it to the customer?" Listening in, it occurred to me that when it came to running a restaurant kitchen, there are worse qualities than a shortage of emotional sensitivity. Monica knows how to get things done. But the yelling couldn't be good for a headache. Before I said goodbye, I'd recommend she drink cinnamon tea instead of wasting money at urgent care. There's nothing better for headaches, and nothing truly wrong with Monica, I was sure of it. Too bad I didn't have a remedy for Grace's problems. She wasn't exactly shy, but she was uncomfortable around new people. It took weeks for her to open up to me and Monica. Now, there she was, stuck having dinner with a complete stranger. Headache or not, Monica should have had a little more consideration. Poor Grace. What was she doing right now? Whatever it was, I was sure she was absolutely miserable.
Chapter 6. Grace. If I were a prisoner on death row, requesting my last meal, I'd ask for a dozen succulent, briny, coppery-tasting Olympia Bay oysters. They are, pun intended, to die for. So delicious, so decadent, that I'd almost be willing to delve into the sad and complicated explanation of my sad and complicated life in exchange for them. But I didn't have to. Luke and I made a pact to steer clear of personal stuff and just enjoy a good meal and some inconsequential conversation, starting with our all-time favorite TV shows. Luke said he liked The Office because sometimes you just want to laugh and not think. I like reruns of I Love Lucy for the same reason. Moving on to our favorite movies, I picked When Harry Met Sally and he picked Star Wars, both pretty predictable. He told me a little bit about his work. Not the business part or the details of how he'd gotten into it, but about what it felt like to actually work with wood. Even if you're using a machine, sanding wood is time-consuming, but I like to do it by hand. It's almost meditative, he smiled. Kind of magical, too. Think about it. The only way to make that piece of wood smooth, to refine and reveal its true character and purpose, is by rubbing this piece of rough, gritty paper over it again and again and again. I spend a lot of time up front, thinking about the design of a piece, but once I start in with the actual work, the cutting and hammering and sanding and finishing, I don't have to think. Maybe because I've been doing it for so long now. It's like, at some point, instinct kicks in, or muscle memory. When I'm in that space where I don't have to think, just do, I'm more myself than at any other time. He looked at me, looking at him, and laughed self-consciously. Sorry, it's hard to explain, and I'm talking too much. No, you're not, and I completely get what you mean, I said, thinking about my quilt blocks, but I didn't tell him why, and thankfully he didn't ask. I could tell he wanted to, but he stuck to our bargain, steered clear of the complicated stuff. Even so, I learned a lot about Luc Pascal that evening. One of the more telling parts of the conversation came when we discussed books. I used to read a lot. Growing up, books were my refuge and the characters in them my best, and sometimes only, friends. In the previous 2 years, I'd only cracked the spine of one book and still hadn't found time to finish it. Luc's reading list was long and literary. No Country for Old Men, The Book Thief, The Glass Castle, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. One of his choices, however, surprised me. A lot. Twilight? I gasped, practically choking on my wine. Seriously? He popped a piece of calamari into his mouth. Hey, just because a book appeals to popular taste doesn't mean it isn't well written or doesn't examine important themes. Good versus evil, change versus tradition, vampire versus... He furrowed his brow, pretending to concentrate. Other vampires? He reached for the last calamari, but I beat him to it, popped the crunchy morsel into my mouth, chewed slowly, then picked up my wine glass. Uh-huh. Sure, I get it. Fine, he huffed. You found me out. I'm a 15-year-old girl trapped in the body of a middle-aged carpenter. Happy? I choked so hard that the wine went up my nose and splashed onto my dress. Looking down at the wet spot, I started to laugh, and laugh, and laugh. Wow, after only 2 glasses of wine? Either I'm a lot funnier than I used to be, or you're the biggest lightweight in the world. I'm not much of a drinker, I admitted. No kidding? I'd never have guessed. He took a gulp of his wine and thumped the glass onto the table. Hey, do you want to dance? What? Dance? No. Oh, come on, he stood up. The band is really good. Can't let it go to waste. The band, really more of a combo, was good. But until Luke mentioned it, I hadn't noticed.
To me, it was just background noise. Was he serious? He didn't really expect me to get up and dance. Did he? He held out his hand. I can't. Really, Luke, I'm a terrible dancer.
Doesn't matter. He flashed a cocky smile. I'm good enough for both of us. My parents taught ballroom. Follow my lead. I won't let you look stupid. Promise.
This was not a good idea. I was sure of it. My brain told me I should say goodnight then and there. But my body, full with food and warm with wine, hypnotized by those amber eyes, wasn't quite as sure. I reached for his hand and he helped me up, his strong arm a counterweight in my hesitant ascent.
Nobody else is dancing, I protested, becoming nervous as we approached the shiny, pristine, possibly never-before-used parquet dance floor.
More space for us, Luke said, taking my left hand in his right.
People are looking at us, I hissed.
They're jealous.
But,
Grace, have you ever been to this restaurant before? I shook my head. Neither have I. What do you care if they look? We'll never see these people again.
Before I could argue, Luke stepped off in time to the music, moving with such surety that I had no choice but to follow, trusting that he knew what he was doing. And he did. Which is not to say that the touch of Luke's hand suddenly transformed me into Ginger Rogers. There were several missteps, some left turns that should have been right, but Luke covered for me and, true to his word, never let me look stupid. Two songs in, I realized that the more I relaxed and quit trying to think, the easier it was. Four songs in, I was actually starting to enjoy myself. A little. The fifth song was fun, peppy with a Latin beat. Near the end, Luke raised his hand and mine, then put a gentle pressure on my shoulder to send me under the arch of our arms. I twirled like a top, around and around, all the way across the floor. My skirt flared out so wide, it looked like the flamingos were about to take flight. The song ended and I nearly collapsed from dizziness and laughter.
See? You're having fun, he said, holding out his hand for another dance.
Can't, I puffed, my chest heaving. Need to catch my breath.
One more, he urged as the band started playing. Come on, it's a slow one.
I took a big breath. Okay. One more. Luke led me to the middle of the floor and laid his hand flat on my back. I rested my fingertips on his shoulder and looked into his face, watching for his silent countdown, three small and steady nods, before stepping off. A few measures in, the keyboardist put a muted trumpet to his lips, blowing a smoky, bluesy twilight tune. The bass player plucked out a pulsing harmony, as steady as a beating heart, and the drummer circled the snare with a metallic brush, making a scratching sound that spoke of closing time. The music was slow, almost too slow. Luke shortened the length of his stride and the distance between us. Steps became a shuffle. The soles of my shoes brushed the floor, soft as a whisper. We moved in unison, drawing closer, meeting in the middle, our bodies touching. My head turned instinctively, feeling suddenly heavy, the way it does just before sleep, sinking lower and lower until my cheek rested on Luke's shoulder. The music was sweet in my ears. I felt so relaxed and good. I closed my eyes. If not for the steady boundaries of Luke's arms holding me close, I might have melted. I was aware of his breathing and my own, of the warm imprint of his hands between my shoulders and the curving swell where my waist became my hip. I could stay here forever, just like this, forever. And then I remembered. My eyes opened, my head lifted. I was suddenly aware of my left hand and the indentation at the base of my finger, the place where my ring should have been. I have to go.
Now? Luke asked. His eyes opened, too.
Why? I just do. I'm sorry, Luke. I can't.
I stepped backward, disentangling myself from his arms, regaining my grip on reality. I walked to the table and he followed me, asking questions that I chose not to answer, saying only what I'd said before, that I was sorry, that I had to go. And I did. I had to.
I grabbed my purse and headed for the door, my stride so long and rapid that I was almost running. He followed me again but gave up after a few paces, falling away, letting me go. It was a relief. I got in the car and drove off, but not to my condo. There was someplace else I needed to be. Twice in one day, I was late. Chapter 7. Grace. The lobby was deserted and the reception desk unmanned, but I didn't need directions. I knew the way. Left from the lobby, right at the corridor, to the end of the hall. A woman with brown hair striped gray at the part looked up from her desk. I forced a smile. Hi, Alicia. How's he doing? Hi, Grace. I didn't think you were coming in. I just checked on him. He's fine. Fine means the same. The same as yesterday and last week and last month and last year. The same. Not better. Better was not going to happen. Now there were only two possibilities. The same and worse. Well, I'll get out of your hair. I'm just going to stay for a few minutes.
Are you okay?
She frowned, examining my face. Alicia knows me pretty well by now. Busy. You know how it is. But I'm fine, I said. I was fine. I was the same. Or would be. I'd had a momentary lapse in judgment. It wouldn't happen again. I wouldn't let it. I tiptoed into Jamie's room, thinking he might be asleep, and felt an involuntary jolt run through my body, the kind of sensation you get from walking across thick carpeting in socks and then touching something metallic, a short, sharp shock that makes your muscles twitch and your breath catch. Even after all that time, coming up on 2 years, when I saw my once oak-strong husband, the man with deep roots, lying in bed, shrunken, and dependent on the ministrations of nurses to eat, control his bowels, and simply survive, I felt that same inward gasp. Sometimes it was hard to make myself believe the body in the bed truly belonged to my Jamie. He was awake, looking toward the doorway as if he'd been waiting for me. Maybe he was. I couldn't tell. That was the worst part of all of this. Though his eyes looked the same as they always had, deep steely blue fringed with thick bristles of shoe-polished black lashes, there was no way for me to tell what he thought or didn't think, or if he could think at all. The doctors said no. At times like this, I wasn't so sure. I stood next to his bed, but his gaze remained fixed on the open doorway. I brushed hair from his face. Still, he watched the door. Who was he waiting for? You need a trim, I said. I can bring the scissors next time I come. He didn't respond. I didn't expect him to. That didn't stop me from talking. When Jamie was still in the coma, he never opened his eyes or responded in any way. For a time, he couldn't even breathe on his own. The medical staff urged me to talk to him anyway. They said it might help him recover, so I did, telling him about the little inanities of my day, how beautiful the trees were when autumn arrived, turning orange, red, and gold, how they'd raised the cable prices so I canceled the service, how I'd met Nan and Monica, adopted Maisie, found a new recipe for chili, or a sweater on sale at Macy's, how I'd decided to stitch 2 dozen cardinal Christmas ornaments made from red felt and embroidered with gold and black thread to give to the nurses. Little things, ordinary things, the daily details of living life and passing the time, waiting for something to happen, good or bad. Stupid things that I felt stupid saying when all I really wanted to do was sob and beg him to wake up and open his eyes. One day, he did. I was so phenomenally happy, convinced that it was only a matter of time before he recovered completely. Talking to him was easier after that. It became a habit that stuck with me even after I was educated about the stages of recovery for brain injury and understood that the progression from coma to persistent vegetative state to minimally conscious to conscious isn't always a continuous line. Some people start at A and progress all the way to Z. Others get stuck and stay there forever. Jamie got stuck.
He could breathe on his own, had sleep and wake cycles, blinked, sometimes followed things with his eyes. He could move his limbs, but not on command, laugh or cry, but not as an appropriate emotional response. It was just something he did. I pulled a chair up close to the bed.
Sorry I'm late. I went out to dinner at the fish house. That's why the dress, I explained, fanning the skirt, spreading the wings of the flamingos. Monica was supposed to come too. I never would have gone otherwise, but then she had a crisis and canceled at the last second. So it was me and Luke and...
Jamie made a choking sound. That happened fairly often, but I jumped to my feet, looked into those eyes that looked through me, making sure he was okay.
Babe, listen to me. I wouldn't have gone if I'd known that Monica was going to cancel. But I couldn't walk off and leave him alone, could I? The dancing was a mistake. I see that now. But there was nothing to it. I thought it would be nice, this once, to have a nice dinner, wear a pretty dress, and spend time with a handsome...
The words caught in my throat.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean it that way. I just wanted not to be alone. Can you blame me?
I asked, lifting my head toward the ceiling, speaking to the empty air, the invisible, wordless presence I felt pressing in on me.
I'm 31 years old. I'm human. I miss having a man to talk to and laugh with. I miss being admired and important to someone. Is that so wrong? It's not like any of this is my fault.
Jimmy coughed again, and I took his hand, feeling for the spot on his thumb where the skin was still thick, a final testament to all the things those hands were once able to do.
I know, it wasn't anybody's fault. You were just being who you are. But don't you see? It was just dinner, a dress, a dance. I didn't see any harm in it. I was just being me, being who I was when we were still us. Do you remember?
Jamie turned his head and gazed toward the empty doorway, resuming his vigil. He was tired, I could tell. Soon he would sleep. I would stay until he did. I sat down in the side chair on the seat cushion that had molded to fit my frame over these long months and pulled out the clear zippered pouch I carried with me everywhere, filled with scraps of red, green, white, brown, and blue. My habit of carrying handwork was an old one. When you spend a lot of time in hospitals, clinics, and doctors' waiting rooms, it's a good idea to bring along something to do. I pulled out a big 8-inch square of plain, cream-colored fabric and smoothed it out across my lap. It was more of a patch than a block, but I planned to put it in the center of the quilt. It would be the biggest individual patch of fabric in the quilt. Measuring from side to side, I was the biggest girl in my high school. At the start of senior year, I stood 5'5" and weighed 228 pounds. Like this block, I tried hard to blend in, to go unnoticed. It's a coping mechanism familiar to most overweight kids or anyone who was bullied as a child. You quickly learn that the way to keep from being picked on is to attract as little attention as possible, and so you become wallpaper. Try to blend into the background and go unnoticed because it seems the only way to survive. Yet no one truly wants to become invisible. Everyone, no matter how fat or slow or tall or ugly or beautiful, wants to be important and loved, the center of someone's world. When I was 18, Jamie Saunders saw me. He wasn't the smartest guy in the class or the best looking, or really the best anything. But everybody in school knew and liked Jamie. He was friendly to everyone, said hello to every single person he passed in the hall, regardless of their social standing, even me. But our first real conversation took place in the lobby of the local medical center, near the beginning of senior year. I was sitting in a corner of the lobby, my face to the wall, crying. I felt his presence even before he spoke and was wiping away tears when he asked if I was okay, then sat down next to me on the love seat, even though there wasn't much room. He was wearing a light blue chambray shirt. "What's wrong?" he asked. "It's okay. You can tell me." Something about the way he said it made me believe it was true. I told him about my failed appointment
and how the doctor had denied my request, saying I was too young and not obese enough to justify the risk of surgery. That's the first time in my life anybody, especially a doctor, said I wasn't fat enough. Wish I'd brought along a tape recorder. I could play it back for my mom. I tried to make a joke of it, but couldn't. What does he want me to do? Buy a case of potato chips so I can get fat enough to finally get thin? It's so stupid. Jamie frowned. I'm sorry, Grace. That really sucks. It did. Hearing him say so didn't change anything, but it made me feel better. I said thanks and asked where he was going. Orthopedist appointment. I went out for cross-country and my knees hurt. My mom wants me to get checked out. Penny was standing with her back to us, looking out the window toward a small garden with orange mums and a fountain. Your mom is waiting, I said. Don't worry about me. I'm fine. I mean, I will be.
You sure?
I nodded.
I think so, too, he said. And for some reason, I believed him. He seemed trustworthy. And that's how it all started.
I took some patches from the bag, the same off-white I was using in the center, and some blue chambray, scraps from a shirt Jamie would never wear again. This block, a friendship star, would represent our beginning, a moment of kindness, a sea change neither of us saw coming. I threaded my needle and started sewing, as I did every night, passing time, marking time, keeping my eyes on my stitches, refusing to look at the door or think about who Jamie was waiting for, or when they might come.
Chapter 8. Nan. Monica's normal speaking voice lies somewhere between bass drum and foghorn, but with Nelson asleep on Monica's lap, I had to turn the water down so I could hear what she said when she leaned forward, searching Grace's face. So, did you sleep with him?
Of course not, Grace snapped. What a thing to ask.
Then what's the big deal? Monica looked disappointed. The way you were acting, I thought you were getting ready to tell us all the sordid details. Sheesh.
The point is that I wanted to sleep with him, Grace said, her expression as pained as her voice. Or at least that I thought about it for a minute.
Who wouldn't? You're not made of stone, are you? Luke is gorgeous. Not my type, of course, Monica said with a shrug. As we all know, I prefer men short, dark, and serially unfaithful. But aside from him being too good for me, what woman with a pulse wouldn't want to sleep with Luke Pascal?
That's fine for them, Grace countered. Or for you. But I can't. I'm married.
Monica's smile faded. She dropped her teasing tone.
Are you? Stop it, Monica.
Grace, it's a fair question. Are you? I shut the sink water off completely, cocking an ear for Grace's response.
Well, I think you should sleep with him,
Monica said breezily when Grace failed to answer.
Somebody should. He's too good to waste. Go right ahead. Be my guest.
Monica spooned a bite of baked apple into her mouth and shook her head.
Uh-uh. He's too young for me. The whole cougar thing sounds good, but it almost never works out. Also, not Italian.
She shook her head again.
Can't be me. Has to be you.
Won't be, Grace said. Not with Luke, not with anybody. For better or worse, Monica. Till death do us part. That's what married means.
Sure, I get it,
Monica said, spreading her hands. And I admire your loyalty. And yes, technically and legally you're married. But isn't marriage more than a promise and a piece of paper? It's supposed to be a relationship, right? Thus the phrase marital relations. You haven't had either of those, a relationship or relations, for close to 2 years. Over all this time, you've been there for Jamie, which is great. But he hasn't been there for you, because he can't. Grace is normally the quiet one of the group, and not given to emotional outbursts. But she shoved her chair back from the table so hard that the sound of the legs scraping on the floor woke Blixen,
who had been sleeping by the back door. Picking up on her distress, Blix got to her feet, crossed the room, and laid her head on Grace's knee. It didn't seem to help.
"What is wrong with you, Monica? Why would you say something like that? Don't you think that he wants to..."
Monica raised her hands.
"Okay, sorry. I didn't mean it like that. I'm not saying Jamie did anything wrong or abandoned you. He didn't plan or deserve this. But neither did you. Think about it, Grace. Think about what you just said. For better or worse, till death do you part. Jamie hasn't looked at you or talked to you or engaged with anyone in any way since the accident. At this point, his life is like your marriage, a technicality."
Monica leaned even closer, trying to lock eyes with Grace.
"Don't say that to me, Monica. I mean it. Do it again and I'll leave."
Grace, who wouldn't look at Monica, started stroking Blixen's head, but hard, as if she were pressing out a layer of stiff dough. Monica fiddled with her fork, then looked at me.
"What do you think?"
I took the copper kettle off the stove, carried it to the table, and filled the cups. "I think it's time to talk about something else." Apart from the gurgling sound coming from the kettle spout, the room was silent. I sat down, sipped my tea, and waited. You can't force these things. Nobody in the world wants to be instructed or lectured. Even when you have something to offer, it's better to wait to be asked. At least if you actually want to help someone. Grace, who had eaten no more than a third of her dessert, pushed her bowl to Monica's side of the table. A peace offering.
"Fine," Monica muttered, picking up her spoon. "What should we talk about?"
Monica looked at me, and I looked at Grace. "We could talk, really talk, or we could change the subject and chat. It was up to her."
After a moment, she said, "I just don't understand what happened. All we were doing was dancing. Why should I suddenly be flooded with feelings for a man I hardly know? It felt so strange and out of control."
She looked toward me, inviting my answer.
"Could it be pointing to something that's missing in your life?" I asked. "Grace, when we talked on the phone yesterday, you were so excited about dressing up and going out. I've never heard you so happy. Between work and worries about Jamie's care, you're under constant stress. How long has it been since Jamie's accident?"
20 months. He fell in June. It was 3 weeks before he woke up. 2 weeks after that, he was admitted to Lansdowne.
Almost 2 years. Are you really surprised that a little attention from a nice-looking man left you so vulnerable? You're only human. And Monica, this daily battle to run the restaurant and deal with the kids is wearing on you, too, I said. Look, I think you've both been doing an amazing job of coping in terrible circumstances. But if you're going to keep coping, you need a bit of joy in your lives.
But we've got this, Grace said, spreading her hands. We've got one another, and our Monday nights. I don't know what I'd do without them.
I smiled. I know, I feel the same. But one night a week isn't quite enough to hang a whole life on, is it? When you were young, before you got married, what did you do for fun?
Jamie and I got married at 19, Grace said. So we're talking about high school. Back then, my hobbies were watching reruns of the Andy Griffith Show and eating entire cheesecakes, preferably at the same time. I'm not sure it made me happy, just kind of damped down the depression.
Cooking used to make me happy, Monica said. As a mostly ignored child descended from a long line of stoic Lutherans from cold climates, I had fantasies about growing up and having the big, happy, vaguely Italian family. She smiled to herself. I'd dream of an overcrowded dinner table, people laughing and arguing and yelling and talking with their hands, devouring huge platters of pasta and veal and sausage, sauces made with tomatoes and cream and red wine, all prepared by me, the mother of this big, boisterous brood.
When I met Vince, it seemed like a dream come true. He was this handsome, passionate Italian man with two kids, a good start on a ready-made family. But look, she said in a practical tone, I didn't kid myself. I knew that Vince and I weren't exactly star-crossed lovers, but we liked each other. I was actually excited about being a stepmother. At my age, I knew it wasn't likely, but I kind of hoped there'd be time for Vince and me to pop out a bambino of our own, maybe even two, before my biological clock struck midnight. Well, Vince was passionate, all right, she said bitterly. Just not about me. While I took care of his restaurant, house, and kids, he was out betting every blonde in Portland. What a chump I was. Anyway, she muttered before taking another swallow of tea. That kind of spoiled cooking for me. Now it's just a job, an exhausting grind. As far as the kids, if we could manage to sit down at the table without a fight breaking out, I'd still enjoy cooking for them. But I've given up. Let's put cooking aside for now, I said. When you were a kid, what else did you like to do? Anything they told me not to. She grinned wickedly, and I couldn't help but laugh. Monica's sarcasm can be a little hard to take sometimes, but there is something truly lovable about her.
Hey, Grace said. I hate to break up the party, but I have to get going. I need to be at the office early tomorrow.
I should get going, too, Monica said, then scooped Nelson gently from her lap and set him down on the floor. While I got coats from the closet, Grace and Monica put the cups into the dishwasher and tidied up the kitchen. When they were getting ready to leave, Monica turned to me and said,
I totally forgot. You called the restaurant last night. What did you need?
Oh, nothing that urgent, I said, and opened the front door. I'm just worried about the rescue. End-of-the-year contributions were down, and medical expenses are up. We need to come up with a way to raise some money, and I thought you might have some ideas. We can talk about it next week.
Come by the restaurant tomorrow, she said. We'll do a little brainstorming.
Thanks. I have to take Nelson to the vet in the morning. We'll drop by after.
Grace zipped up her jacket and looked at Monica.
I almost forgot. What did the doctor say about your headaches?
She told me to take some aspirin. Hey, just because it wasn't serious doesn't mean it couldn't have been, she protested.
Come on, Grace, quit laughing. I had to put up with enough of that from Hazel.
Hazel?
The urgent care doctor. She works the 4 to midnight shift.
Wait, you're not only on a first-name basis with the urgent care doctor, but you know her work schedule?
Grace, still chuckling, gave me a squeeze and headed toward her car with Monica on her heels.
You know, Monica said, you're going to feel really terrible if something bad ever does happen to me.
You're right, I will, Grace said. If.
After waving them off, I went back inside, turning out the lights on my way back to the kitchen. The grandfather clock was ticking steadily. The dogs were snoring. And the house felt too big. It always does after visitors leave.
It would pass.
It was easier when the kids were still at home. Now I have to work at it, be more intentional. That's what I was trying to explain to Monica and Grace. I poured the lukewarm tea water down the drain and noticed that the kettle looked dull. I hadn't planned on polishing the copper for another week, but now was as good a time as any, and I didn't feel tired. In fact, I was still a little restless, like I had been at dinner. Maybe I ought to stick to herbal tea, eliminate the caffeine entirely. I'd been feeling restless so often of late. I took my collection of copper down from the pot rack, 3 pots, 2 saucepans, and 7 gelatin molds that rarely saw use anymore, which was a shame. Gelatin salads are such fun to eat, and so refreshing. Unfortunately, they'd fallen out of fashion. But fashions come and go, so I held on to my copper molds and polished them every other month. When the gelatin renaissance arrives, I'll be ready. I mixed up some lemon juice with baking soda, put the mixture on a clean cloth, and got to work, rubbing the surface of a saucepan in little circles, smiling as the color began showing beneath the layer of tarnish. It's a very satisfying thing, polishing copper. The phone rang. It was awfully late for someone to be calling. Had Grace or Monica left something behind? Hello? There was coughing on the other end of the line, a loose, wet, ragged sound. I knew right away who was making it.
Danny? Mom, I'm sick. I need money for a place to stay. Where are you? Under a bridge. It's freezing. You have to give me some money.
I closed my eyes and pressed a fist to my lips. Danny, I can't do that.
But I'm sick. I have a fever. Don't you care? What kind of mother are you?
She started coughing again. I felt my heart clutch and my resolve begin to crack, but I couldn't crack. I'd been down this road before.
Danny, I'm not going to give you money for drugs.
It's not for drugs. Why don't you ever listen? I told you, I'm sick and need money for a place to stay.
Her tone went from demanding to wheedling.
I'm freezing, Mom. It's starting to snow. Bring me some money, please.
I looked out the window. It was cold, very cold, but it wasn't snowing. In former days, I would have believed her. Now I knew better. Everything that Danny said required confirmation. She was a habitual liar. Though, I reminded myself, it wasn't really Danny who was lying to me. It was the drugs. Danny was sick. The absence of heroin in her system resulted in sweating, shaking, weakness, nausea, and even hallucinations. In this state, she was a hostage to her addiction. In some ways, so was I.
Honey, listen to me. You need help. I've talked to counselors at a very good rehab, a nice place. Tell me where to find you. I'll take you...
I didn't get to finish. She cut me off, spitting out curses and accusations with the same kind of fury and fear that grips a wild animal caught in a trap. I tried to talk over her, to make her see reason, but it was no use. There was more cursing, then a strangled cry of frustration, before the phone went dead. I stood there, heart pounding, listening to the dull buzz of the dial tone. I wiped away tears and went back to my copper, rubbing so hard that my arms burned, refusing to stop until every shadow and stain was gone and each piece glowed like the embers of a fading fire.
Chapter 9. Grace. My alarm went off at 5 the next morning, as usual. After breakfast, I took Maisie for a walk, said hello to Sunny and Zee, the homeless couple who lived in the next block, and patted their dog Cujo on the head. In the days since my encounter with Luke, I was trying to be more outgoing. It had been a little embarrassing, walking up and introducing myself, but Sunny and Zee were very friendly. Why had I waited so long to speak to them? After changing into my work clothes, I went to Lansdowne to see Jamie. The nursing shift changes at 7, so it was a good time to check in with them. Then I drove to the office, arriving just in time for the monthly company-wide meeting. Those meetings were usually pretty boring and a waste of time. They started with announcements from HR, reminders to clean old lunches out of the break room refrigerator, pitches to sign up for the 401k plan, that sort of thing. Then the higher-ups gave the previous month's performance numbers and a speech on doing better in the month to come. After that, they announced the employee of the month, and everybody ate bagels. Theoretically, it was a mandatory meeting, but about a third of the office usually didn't bother to show, or only came in at the end for bagels. This Tuesday, everybody was there. Everybody. And they were dead silent. Something wasn't right. The chairs were nearly full. My four bosses, Jack Shapiro, Pete Ryan, Mark Deloitte, and Ava Goddard, were sitting together in the sixth row, but there were no seats with them. So I walked to the back of the room. I found a spot against the wall and stood next to Denise Fine, who worked in accounting.
"What's going on?" I whispered.
Not sure, she said, talking out of the side of her mouth. But something. There have been rumors. What kind of rumors? Denise shifted her eyes to the front of the room and a chair on the far left,